Good morning, good morning. We are dancing in with Soul Mikasa, Mano Dibango. This is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, right here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1, with your Friday Speak Up Show. Have we got a treat in store for you. It's your own Sister C. With Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon What You Will Hear Today. Today, I'm sharing interviews that I did with two creative stars this week, Juno Award-winning vocalist Kelly Lee Evans and award-winning documentary filmmaker Adele Arope. In today's show, you'll hear about three things they have in common: remarkable resilience in rebounding from disruptive injuries, dedication to their creative expression, and achieving new audiences through not only singing and writing, but sharing their self-care practices with others, like you today. And away we go. This morning, my treat for you is an interview with Kelly Lee Evans. She is a vocalist, a teacher, a mother, an inspirer, and she knows a thing or two about turning life around. So you're going to be hearing that in just a moment. It's good to see you. Good morning, Kelly. Good
morning.
I am so happy to have you as our guest today. We spoke about a year ago, and you were planning this wonderful tour, and then COVID happened. And so I want you to share just a little bit of what was happening in your life at the point that this wonderful year began.
Let me think now. Well, when we went on lockdown for COVID, we were just part of the last group of people to leave France before the US shut down flights coming for like out. So it's funny because, I mean, that somewhat didn't affect us, but it was still like the airports were closing, you know? And we had one more show to give in a city called Rennes in the northern part of France. And I was like, the whole time I'm thinking, I'm ready to go home. Like from, I guess it was the first day, because I was there with my daughter, she was touring with me, and we would just keep looking at each other and we'd be like, what is going on? You know, there were hardly any masks. The only masks I saw were maybe some other tourists. And I was like, I don't know, I don't feel good. And I'm here like lathering up in antibacterial sanitizer, and I'm looking around and people think I'm crazy, and I'm just like, I don't know, like I don't feel good, you know. And every day I would say to my booking agent, I'm like, I think we should go home, and he'd be like, oh no, it's fine. And then it wasn't fine. You know what I mean? And like even like when we were going back, I remember being in the airport and I had Lysol wipes, and you have the touch screen. And I'm wiping down the touchscreen, and the people around me are looking at me like I'm crazy. And I'm not like an overly, like, that's not my vibe. Like, I'm not just like, I'm not like, not, I hug people, I shake hands. Before all this, I was like that person who was just like all over everybody. But at that time, I was sufficiently nervous where, yes, I felt uncomfortable, you know? And I remember, yeah, I wiped it down for the person who was going to use it next. And they were like, what's the big deal? And we had masks with us, but we hadn't put them on yet, because I was like, well, maybe we are overdoing it, you know? And then when I got on that plane, the last plane to go back was an Air Canada flight. And the only people, there were like maybe two or three people wearing normal people wearing masks, and all the staff were wearing masks. And I said to my daughter, put your mask on. And that was it.
Yes.
That was it. You know what I mean? And it was just kind of like this moment where like things just changed. And I remember even like the day before, like when we knew we had to go back home, they canceled that last show. Like they had decided, the French government decided, okay, we don't want any more gatherings over 50 people, or it was over 100, and we had a concert of like about 300. And so we were like, okay, well, we have to go home early. And we went to the grocery store, and I had heard the news in Canada of like people, you know, stocking up. Yes. And I had an empty suitcase, and I went and I bought all these groceries, and there was nobody in the store. Even though they were going on lockdown the next day. Like, it was just different. And so when I look back, this is the first time I'm looking back, really, you know, because of your question, because we've just kind of gotten used to this as being the new normal. But yeah, thinking back like to the day before, it really became something, you know, for our family at least, and for so many people. So, and now it's, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just saying that when we spoke, you had done this wonderful concert in Ottawa that had raised the most money for the children's Christmas program, and there were just hundreds of people going through. And that's when I saw you, and I said, oh, your story is so fantastic, because you were talking about healing, relaunching, going on tour.
Yeah.
And then, but I know that you are all about self-care. And at the beginning of the year, you set some goals that were not just for you, but for others. What do you want to share what some of those goals were?
I wonder, you know, and I can't even remember them now, but it's so funny. I think so many people, I'll just tell you like what I still do. And I wonder if they really, I would love to go back and listen to some of those goals and to see like where I'm at. I still meditate every day. I still do my yin yoga every day. And I still take a bath, a hot bath every day. You know, I'm still doing my best to keep up with like keeping in touch with all of my family and friends, you know, and constantly just staying on a schedule with that. And I'm not spectacular, but I'm not isolating, you know, like, and that's, it's funny because all of these self-care superpowers, I like to call them, you know, like these things that I created for myself back when it was just me in my house, you know, and everybody else was okay, and I was a sick one, you know, and
yes,
and it was what I needed to do to be able to function. Those were all things that I felt in the beginning, especially the beginning of the pandemic, and maybe today too, really came in handy to share with people who were just experiencing like what it meant to, like, I couldn't go outside because I couldn't move well, like my mobility was affected, but you know, to have yourself, you know, on lockdown, and we, you know, we experienced like the quarantine, we've been on so many quarantines now, especially with my kids being in school, you know, every sniffle is like, do we need to
isolate
again,
quarantine. Yes.
My god,
so are you in Toronto or
I'm in Ottawa?
Ottawa.
Okay. yeah where are you?
Vancouver.
Yes. Yeah. So it's interesting, you know, every region is going through its own thing, but I feel like a lot of the self-care goals that I set out for myself, I continue, because I didn't just make them these like amorphous goals that are like there, that are out there. I actually set up times when they would happen, you know, so they happen on a daily basis before I get started with everything else, so that before life happens, I put these things into place so that I can be available, you know. And they're helping me. I really needed it yesterday. I started working in another job. It was my first grown-up job to just help make ends meet even more, you know, as a mom of three during a pandemic, you gotta do what you gotta do. And it was interesting to see, like, okay, this is what I've been preaching. It's helped me so far. How is it going to help me in this new life as well? Like, that's doing speaking, singing, and like doing this this work outside. So it is so far. I am awake, alive. I feel like I've got some energy this morning.
Yes, yeah. You're radiating energy.
It's my ring light.
We'll just send it out across the airwaves. Coming to you with the rays of energy and health and light. I know you're big on making lists. You suggest that people look at that list every day and pick, would they pick five goals or would they pick one?
It's, but you know what? It's not like a, this list is not like a to-do list per se. This is like this thing that is it's a happy list. It's a list of things. Yeah, it's a self-care list. It's a list of things that make you feel good. And it's a lot different from like, you know, take groceries, like take back, you know, this item to like whatever store, or, you know, do the groceries, or take the kids here or there. It's not that. It's actually sitting down and figuring out what it is that you love, what fills you up? What kind of food does your soul need to eat? And how often does it need it? You know, like, how often do you need to visit with your family? You know, how often do you need to give your cousin a call? How often do you need to take that bath? I know that I need, it's not just a shower. Shower is good, like, gets you clean and it can be nice. And, but like, for me, like, that soak, there's something just luxurious about it. It makes me feel like, even if I'm only doing it for 10 minutes, I feel like I have all the time in the world. You know, and I just want that feeling, and I know I feel good when it happens. So when I talk about lists, yeah, like I did like those lists of doing things and getting it done and crossing them off. But this list is like a working document where you put it in your phone and you write down all of the things that you enjoy doing. And then the second part of the list is to look at your schedule and figure out, when am I going to do these things on a regular basis? How often am I gonna go for a walk? How often am I gonna spend time with my cat or dog? You know, how often am I gonna schedule time to be with my kids or my best friend? Or, and making that part of your week, part of your month, part of your year, so that these things don't just stay out there in the ether, that they actually become living things that happen for you, part of your life.
Yeah, that seems like that's part of the formula for your signature song, one of your signature songs, Unbreakable. Because right at the, you know, after that Christmas fundraiser, you were getting calls and you had this amazing tour that was unfolding. You were just a month into that when COVID hit?
Yeah.
And so you talked about, you know, wanting to get home, but how did that feel inside? What did you, some people went into such devastation, but you're smiling and have energy. How did you cope with looking at, now I'm back out there, and then suddenly it's gone?
I think because it's happened to me before, you know, like I've had so many experiences now where I kind of had this sense that things are not, like, you don't have the control you think you have, mm-hmm. You know, like with the first situation. Well, it's not even the first, like my mom passed away when I was, I think, 23. And that's when I first saw just how short life is, you know, mm-hmm. Like sitting, being in the hospital room with her when she took her last breath. And then, I mean, she was not that much older than I am right now. And so it's very humbling. And then after that, I had my own accident. You know, I went into anaphylactic shock, and I almost died. And I was just like, "Oh, okay,
you okay?
Okay." You know, you realize it's like, this is not given. Like, you're not going to be given 100 years. You know, like, we have no idea when it's done. And so that really kind of lit a fire under my butt to go out and get all this stuff done. And I think for a long while, I thought I was out there controlling what was happening. You know, I was like just willing things to happen. But then when the lightning strike hit happened, and that was like, that was unreal. You know what I mean? Like, that was just like, wow.
Totally,
like,
here's unreal.
Yeah, unreal. It's like, I think I've got boundless energy and I'm going to be able to do this and do that. And then all of a sudden, you get struck down and you realize, like, okay, no, I actually don't get to choose where and what and how much energy I'm going to put into something. That now it's my body, you know, and my body's making those decisions. And even then, so I think I still thought, oh, okay, well, I'm still going to try to force. I'm still going to force my way and try to make things happen. And then, bang, I hit my head. And went down again. And this is like before I could, like, just put me in the wheelchair and I'll be fine. Like, just if somebody pushes the wheelchair, I'll still get out to these concerts. I'll still sing. Can't hold my microphone, no problem. Just put it in front of me, I'll sing. That was my mentality after the lightning strike. And then I got my mobility back and I was able to walk, but I was still pushing it. And then to faint and hit my head and be out for another 2 years, you realize it's like, wow. I mean, something is saying, like, slow down, you know, like all these ideas I have to move faster, actually you know, there's a limit. There is a limit. And so, yeah, I think knowing that and having had those experiences made it much easier for me during the pandemic to be like, oh, okay, mm-hmm. you know, no right. problem. You want us all to sit here for, okay, we can do that.
So you had written Unbreakable before you had that experience with the lightning or concussion?
I think so, yeah. Because it was like I'm pretty sure, let me see. No, it was after. I wrote that after, but before the head injury.
How did that kind of work with you in your bouncing back?
Oh, you know, there's another, it's not even just an appreciation for her, but just an appreciation for people in that time, for not just artists in that time, but for just human beings, like, you know, like us in that time, and what people were going through. I mean, I can't even imagine. Like, I was looking at a quote about the new Billie Holiday documentary that's coming out, and one of her musicians was trying to explain to the interviewer, he was like, you can't even use the bathroom.
Right.
Like, imagine. I mean, we go through that here and there where people, you know, just people just don't want, like, stores don't want you to use their bathroom. Like, you know.
Right.
But imagine, like, the person that doesn't look like you beside you can use that bathroom. But you have to go, you know, we're women. Like, if you need to use the bathroom, like, you need some privacy.
Yes.
And to imagine, like, she would have to go into a bush. But these people were, like, totally okay with her coming and singing for them. But she had to go in a bush. Like, to imagine that, like, that mentality and to think about that. So when you think about what Nina Simone was going through back then, it's very humbling. I feel a lot of, you know, just respect for what these people were able to accomplish despite what they were going through. Yeah, so that's, you know, that song, that idea of being unbreakable can just apply to so many situations. I mean, we're just talking about the experiences of one people. There's so many different, you know, experiences that so many different communities and cultures and human beings have gone throughout, and we'll continue to go through throughout history. So, yeah.
That's one of the things that people are really pushing for in the history books and school books in Canada and the U.S., that the history of our people, the history of so many people who had to struggle, who were presenting these gifts. There's stories about the gifts and stories about the music, but about the struggle, about the simplest thing of being able to eat in the same room where you perform, or to invite your guests to come and see you and sit in the front row or wherever they wanted to sit. Yeah. And at the same time, maintain this elegance of singing and performing and making people excited. I say you brought that forward in Unbreakable. And
oh, thank you.
We are, after the song, we're going to explore what are some ways that you pivoted after you got back to Canada, after things had been disrupted?
Well, how am I pivoting? I think the way that I'm pivoting right now is, getting some work out in the public sphere, but I pivoted to my family, you know, like I as a mom and as a single mom, like living with three kids, just doing my best to be a present human being for my family has been my pivot. And it's funny, like now I'm more interested in creating, and I've been creating just some things like in the last couple of weeks, but up to this point I haven't felt like I had the brain space to even consider like what new art might look like. Like you'd think like, oh, you have all this time, like make some music, do some painting, you know, but it's just like I'm just trying to keep this show on the road and my house, you know. it's not easy what kids are going through right now. It's not easy what like a lot of people are going through. And I found just being a human to the people around me has been everything. So trying to like make good meals and get everybody at the table and make sure there's food for everybody and try to support people like for their schoolwork if they can, and then try to show up for my friends as well. I think that's where I spent most of my time. I pivoted just in human connection, you know?
Mm-hmm. How old are your children?
17, 13, and 20.
Oh my. I had three children, but one of them, Atto, it's his birthday today.
Happy birthday!
But having two children going through their teen years at the same time, that is a survival in and of itself.
There it is. Yeah, yeah. I feel like I actually now don't feel bad about, like, you know, not having, like, created all this, like, huge opus during this period. It's just like, nah. I've been creating kids, you know, and it's a big job.
And you could say that people can't see it. She has a big smile and saying, creating kids.
Yeah.
For people who may not know, you exude and talk about your faith and you talk about doing workshops with kids. What are some of the types of workshops that you do with kids?
Well, you know, I've been so lucky to be able to go into this, well, before the pandemic, to go into the schools and talk to them about my experience, about the things that have happened to me, about how, like, I've helped, like, how those things have helped me develop these superpowers of, like, trying to be resilient through using self-care. Mm-hmm. And then also, I sometimes get to help them with songwriting. It really depends on, like, what the school decides. And I've also been lucky to work with some students mentoring at Carleton University. So all the other singers like me that are just coming up, and I mean, giving them the information that I didn't have when I was starting, and just being a sounding board for them. So it's I get to, like, you know, last year I was with children from like grades from kindergarten right up to university. So it's pretty amazing.
I was excited, actually, when they sent out something about people starting to do concerts in the parking lots, where there are these great auditoriums that people went inside to see a concert. You were in that first group of concerts that were out on the parking lot. What was that like?
That was so much fun. It was crazy. I remember we were the first concert of Blues Fest here in Ottawa, and everybody was out in their cars. And it was super, super hot. And your sound comes through their speaker system. And we finished the first song and we were like, gee, like, how will you even hear the applause or anything? And they started to honk their horns. And it was the first time we'd ever experienced anything like that. And it was just such a joyous thing because I think for myself, definitely for myself and the musicians, it was our first big festival back. And for a lot of the people that came to the concert, it was their first time back as well, seeing live music. So I'm really happy that they, you know, they hired us for that. And I'm going to be doing a Christmas concert in December on the 17th and the 18th at the National Arts Center. And that's, I think they're going to be broadcasting online the 18th as well. Yeah, so that's coming.
I'm thinking a word that you could say to some other musicians. Some have been kind of devastated, but others have started doing things like making these virtual concerts where all of the people are singing at the same time.
It's funny, like, I think, you know, hopefully this experience, you know, from this experience, we'll gain a greater understanding of some of the technological things that are necessary to create music for this time. And I'm very hopeful that it's going to lead to some really wonderful things in the future that we never could have imagined before. So I think that, you know, so many people have lost their lives and, you know, livelihoods, and people also have the quality of life may have changed, especially if they've experienced like effects of the virus. And then on the flip side, there have been some good things for so many of us as well. So it's a bittersweet times.
do you find, like with the people that performed at that Blues Fest, are new relationships occurring among musicians?
I wonder, like, you know, we so many of us are in our bubbles, you know, so when we get, I did meet some new friends there, so that was nice, but for a lot of us, we had to be in bubbles, so we couldn't interact with one another, you know, so it's definitely a different time, but I feel like my relationships that I have with some musicians already, like, you know, that I've always had, they seem somewhat even warmer first, but then, like, I am missing just playing live and being with people, so I'm looking forward to those concerts in December.
You'll be able to see people's hands up instead of seeing the screen. That's another of your songs I want to share, Hands Up. But can you tell us a little bit what went into making that song?
Oh, you know, it's exactly that what we talked about earlier, just about realizing that we really don't have a lot of power and a lot of like just the fact that things change so quickly and that things can change in a heartbeat. And that idea that you just put your hands up and accept what's coming, what life has to give you.
Yeah. Now, some of your work, a lot of your work is in French. And when I first was reading about you, I thought that you were born in France and then to Canada.
Yeah, I'm from Scarborough.
Yes. And so how did your development of such fluency in French come about?
Oh, you know what? I've done all of that through just like internet. And I had like a really great, like, I had a really like necessary, I realized when we were going to France so much that it just seemed crazy that I was this Canadian and I only spoke English. So I just decided that, okay, you know what? I am going to learn how to speak French. And I've put just a lot of passion into it. And when the pandemic happened, I decided I wanted to learn to speak German. So that's been my latest project.
Yeah. So I know that you have got to run, but with your hands up, can you tell us three things that you would suggest people do to keep their sunny side up?
Yeah, I would say stay connected to the people around you that I think is some, just like don't isolate, and get that happy list out. Think and keep it with you and figure out how to make that a part of your life. And the other thing is just sleep. You know, get a good night's sleep. I know a lot of times I haven't even recognized how important sleep has been for just my own mental health. So those are the three tips I would share. They're the three things that I'm working on still.
Okay, well, I've got my hands up for you and look forward to hearing you. And maybe you can come back again and share some music through the holiday spirit to help people keep their sunny side up as we are healing together.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, this is Charlotte Farrell, your own Sister C, here in the place to be, CJSF Radio 90.1 in Burnaby. And speaking of pivoting, we're having a pivot in our conversation to speaking with Adele Arope. And Adele is a brilliant young actress, activist, teacher, and sometimes one of our featured co-hosts on the show. But in talking with Kelly Lee Evans, she talked about how she was able to use some daily simple practices to keep herself positive and to kind of roll with the punches of the pandemic. And so you too, I find, are doing, you've had a lot of similarities with Kelly Lee in that you travel, speak different languages. You had a tour that was unfolding around your film. You have a brilliant film. So would you tell us a little bit about the film and then now how things are unfolding where you are talking about, facilitating a discussion about a film festival, as well as screening your own. So Adele, just tell us a bit about your pivoting process.
So I am currently I'm still showcasing my film. I'm I'm about to be a part of the BC Nurses Union Conference. They're having a human rights conference on the 26th. So I'm going to be presenting my film and having a conversation about intergenerational trauma and identity and how kind of the healing process of art and finding a sense of self through different outlets. And I'm also facilitating a conversation for this film festival called MENA. And so a lot of people might not know this, but the MENA region is kind of like the Arab Empire, you know? So it's like Sudan, Tunisia, North Africa, like, you know, as it gets into Qatar and Saudi Arabia, like those, that's all considered the MENA region. And so we are facilitating a conversation about Blackness in the MENA region. So people that are in the roundtable discussion, one girl is a Sudanese Egyptian living in Qatar, and another one is a Afro Iranian man. And so they are both, one is a filmmaker, one has his own podcast. And so we're going to be talking about representation and Blackness. And I kind of find it hilarious because I am like, I'm a South Sudanese cow herder. So that's how I consider myself. Anytime I identify, my mom kind of instilled in me like the understanding of like where I came from. So I never really tried to identify hard, but my great-great-grandmother was actually an orphan that was found by a Sudanese slave, like a South Sudanese slave who was in the North. There's a lot of slavery that was going on, but the Black Africans were slaves. And so my great-great-grandmother was an orphan that was found in like on during one of the breakouts. And so she was adopted into the Dinka community. And so she was a light-skinned, curly hair little girl at 4 years old named Fatna. And then she was given the name Adil, which is my name, which I became her namesake. And so that's the only reason I agreed to facilitating the conversation for my grandma, because I am a part of that region through her. But it's still very interesting because I got a little bit of a bitter taste from all of the terrible history and the way that Black people have been treated. But I also think this is finally an opportunity to really discuss the importance of representation and to know that Black people exist in those regions. And even though the racism there is very intense, I think it's still important to be having these conversations. So it's been really nice that people are looking to me to have a conversation about race and Blackness and representation. I feel really honored, but I never thought that that'd be the position I take, but it's definitely something that I really enjoy. I'm a historian, and me and my friend actually have done about 2,200 years of history. So I think I got prepared. So now I'm like, okay, let's go. What are we talking about here? With the Moorish ruling in the 300 BC in AD, I got you. So,
which is interesting because we talk about Black history and the conversation is so narrowed. And I know you've been an advocate for broadening the diaspora. We often say the African diaspora, but you're still talking about people in Great Britain, the United States, and Canada. So how are you finding that this relates to that work that you're doing with creating something different for the educational program?
Well, actually, so I'm preparing. So I have gotten asked by the Burnaby School District 41 to come back again for Black History Month to facilitate another Black History Month conversation. So last year I did a youth conference around identity. And so I was brought some artists in and we did a whole thing. So this time I feel like now this is allowing me to reach another area. Like before I'm talking about like African history and like the diaspora and in the Americas, but also we're needing to broaden our understanding of the fact that we're everywhere in the world and we are a part of history. It's just that we've been hidden. And so I feel like my obligation is in a sense is to shine a light on the fact that just because we're Black, we're hidden in the shadows, you know? Right. So I think it's time to shine a light on the fact that we've been everywhere and we've been a part of history. And even during 700 AD, when the Moors were in Portugal and in Spain, you know, you only imagine that they were like the Berbers of Morocco, but there were actually some Black Africans as well. So I think it's just really important to broaden our understanding of history and to know that, okay, like we are only fed one type of history, which is how the slaves came to the Americas, but there's also the slaves that went to the MENA region as well. And there is still slavery kind of happening in those areas as well. So I think it's been very interesting to continue to broaden my understanding of history and broaden my understanding of where Blackness is and shining a light on it and then facilitating conversations. One thing that I think is going to be really interesting is one of the filmmakers at the MENA Film Festival, her name is Iman. She made a documentary about bleaching syndrome, and she's going and interviewing women who bleach their skin. And I think that that is a huge epidemic, even in my community. Like, we're very dark-skinned people, especially the Nilotic groups that I come from. And I remember growing up, and there was bleaching creams, and women were, like, lightening their skin. And I even went in and then tried it as well. And my family used to be like, you need to stop trying to change yourself. Like, you are, and you need to just learn to accept it eventually. And so now, like, looking back at her documentary, it's really nice. She has a line that says, I feel like I don't fit in. And it's really nice. It's really it's a universal statement. So
yeah, I think talking about language, you speak six languages, and it's not a thing that people usually expect or anticipate for Black people or Black women. You know, they have even come up with this concept in the States I thought was so ridiculous that it was called Black English. And they said, well, the reason sometimes people say be this and be that is because their lips can't say some words. And it was very maddening for me listening to people who sometimes got interviews on mass media around this Black English thing, because she said that was one of the really interesting things about the role that you're playing in facilitating that discussion.
Yeah, it's super, because like I speak a lot of random languages that don't really go together, right? So I speak Japanese, I speak French, I speak English, I speak Dinka, Arabic, and Swahili, and a little bit of sign language. And so, for example, when I was in Montreal in France, I could go to the Arabic-speaking places and be okay. And I learned four dialects of Arabic from living in Montreal and engaging and interacting, because Arabic is different and it's spoken in different areas, right? So I grew up speaking the Arabic from Sudan, but the Arabic from Sudan is very simple, right? And so as you continue, I learn how to speak the Arabic that they speak in Jordan, or an understanding a little bit more of the accent, because we speak a different tone. So, but when they look at me, they would never expect that I speak Arabic. Like when I'd be in those areas, they're like, because the Arabic speaking Sudanese are a little bit lighter skin than me, and they've got curly hair, and they've got a little bit more like European features because of the mixture. And so when I come into a room, people don't know who I am, what I do, and all they can just do is, you know, stereotype me. But yes, I can be in a room. But what the nice thing is that, like, I can be in a room with a Japanese person, an Arabic-speaking person, and a French person, and I can quietly just sit there and listen to what they're talking about, and not interject, but just be like, you know, that's my secret superpower, is my communication skills, you know? And so one thing that I take pride in is the fact that I can communicate with almost anybody, you know? I speak those 6.5 languages, but I also can understand and like play around with about like 5 other languages. So I'm like, so I can like, my understanding is I can identify 20 languages. I can speak 6.5, and I can like play around with 11. So my brain is just really into communication, and it's all about language. And so I think that people need to stop stereotyping or try to typecast people, because you don't know people's capacity. Like, you cannot look at me and know how the way that my brain functions. Yeah. And so as I'm presenting at these conferences and talking to different people, I'm trying to break a stereotype, you know, like the way that I look, I'm a model, you know, and I've been a model since I was 14 years old, and I've been in the entertainment industry. And so I'm typecasted, and people would just look at me and have an assumption. And so so when I speak and I engage and I interact with people and talk about these issues and talk about history, I just want to be like, look, it's not, I'm more than what I look like. Not only as a Black woman, but also as a model. And I want to inspire little girls not to just think that there's only one direction in life, and you can do a lot of things, you know, and not to get hurt by the fact when people say, like, if you can't be a jack of all trades because you'd be a master of none. I'm like, but yeah, I'd rather master all these things and be able to function in this world and have one thing that I can do great, you know? So I think it's just really important to stop limiting ourselves and limiting our capacity to do things, because the human mind is a very strong instrument. And so when you learn to utilize it and then you learn to communicate, that just opens up a lot of doors. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at.
Now, just, you know, you've spoken a lot about the brain, and that's something, another thing that you have in common with Kelly Lee Evans. She was struck by lightning, which affected her brain and ability to act, but she rushed to get back out there. And so while she was in France, she had a fall because her balance wasn't stable. At that point, she got a worse concussion. And so she had to really pace out her life and still have a kind of unbreakable spirit to come back and revamp her career. And so she shares with people some things that they can do, some things that have helped with her healing, but also some things that are propelling her forward to similar to you. She sings, but she also talks to kids. She talks to people of different ages. She's not typecast as a singer who talks about music, but around meditation and around being happy. What are some daily practices that you do that have helped you in healing?
I would say journaling. So my concussion has been, I think I'm 11 months post-concussion now, and I'm still like facing a lot of like, you know, back pain and neck pain and migraines. Like I was just in the hospital yesterday for a migraine, and it's about not losing your hope, like losing hope, I guess. It's really like, I guess like COVID-19, I think something that can be relatable. You don't know when it's going to end. There's no end in sight, but you're optimistic, right? And there's a lot of talk of, you know, if you try this, or maybe there's this, or there's like soon, you know? And so my concussion journey kind of started right before the pandemic hit. And so I think I found that I needed to really go back in and look inside myself and learn to relax and pace myself, you know, and stop looking at life like a race, you know. Overachieving, it doesn't get you anywhere if you're not happy on the inside. So I think it was really important that, you know, slowing down for a minute and asking yourself, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? And why do I have this insatiable urge to continue to do things? You know, and I even kept trying to push myself to do more, you know? And so like, even when my concussion, when I was freshly concussed, I was at the Vancouver Short Film Festival having talks and talking to students that are in film school and telling them how to become filmmakers. And I'm at like these film festival circuits and I'm in so much pain. My eyes are in pain and I'm just there. And I'm like, why do I feel the need to be here? You know? And I just couldn't stop. And it just kept going and going and going. And for like 3 months from January to about like mid-February after the Black History Month, I was busy. Every like week I was doing something. I was organizing events or doing this and doing that. And I realized, I'm like, I'm not taking any time to heal. And I think that's what prolonged my healing process. And so after going through concussion programs and meeting with different specialists and learning about pacing myself, which just seems like such a simple concept, right? Like just calm down, take it easy, take it step by step. No, that doesn't make any sense to me. I need 12-hour days. Like I gotta do everything all at once at the same time. Like, you know, and so one thing that has really helped me in my journey is, you know, a journaling and listening to motivational speeches. Like every single morning I put on Les Brown and I listen and I say, okay, you got something inside of you. You got greatness within you, you know? And it's just about continuing to find sources of motivation for yourself and to be like, okay, like I am not my circumstances. I am not this moment in time. I am more, you know, there's greatness within me and there's a lot of things that I can overcome and I can accomplish. And so I think it's about kind of like rewiring the conversation inside of your mind and stop beating yourself up for your inability to function at the same capacity you once did, you know? And as you move through different stages of life, you know, you start to lose your certain capacities for things. So I think slowing down and forgiving yourself and understanding that like life is not a race. It's not a sprint. It's a marathon. And then like the longer you can learn to pace yourself, the faster you can learn to pace yourself and take it step by step, life is going to be a lot easier. And learning to breathe too, because I don't think I've even taken a breath as I'm trying to spit all this information out. So.
What do you listen to, a particular kind of music?
Yeah, I do. I listen to, well, depending on what time of day it is. So I usually try to figure out what my mood is and put music to it. So I kind of score my emotions. So I like listening to binaural beats for when I need to focus. And then I like to listen to trap music if I want to get motivated, dancing. Or I listen to a lot of soulful music, and I like to sing for myself. So I play that, and that usually helps me. If I'm really in a weird mood or in a bad mood, I'll just sing and put on music. Last time I did, it was Whitney Houston, I Will Always Love You, and The Hero by Mariah Carey, and just kept going and just re-listening to them over and over again. Also, Etta James, I'd Rather Go Blind. She's got a live.
Yes.
You know that live performance where she goes, oh, yeah, you know?
Just let go and let it rip, yeah.
History. So after jazz music, right, in the 1920s, I think it was Duke Ellington and one of the other fathers of jazz music, they went to Cuba and they created something called Cubop. Right. Mm. So it's a mixture of Latin, and then they have an African drum and then the instrument. So they have a three layered. And so they were taking their African roots, right? Because both Cuba and America have these ties, but they've taken the drums and they've taken those things and they've created it. I don't know if the new one you're listening to now is from that same line of music, but Cubop. It was created by the jazz musicians in America and some of the people in Cuba, and they made a Cubop, and it's a very interesting sound.
Yeah, it's quite nice. There are three or four things that I found while just listening for things to change my mood that they're projects. They're called the Caribbean Project or Jazz Caribbean African Music. So I'm going to be exploring.
And I also went through and picked out every African country, put it on a thing, and then I put a sound. So I think I have maybe 25. I haven't put a sound for every single country, but I wanted to show how. Because I feel like the way that we look at diversity is through visuals, right? We always say, yes, this person looks like this. This person's from here, you know? So I wanted to show that Africa is not a country. It's a continent. And I wanted to show how it was different. So I put a sound to every country. It was hard for me to finish it because of my concussion and my lack of screen time. But once I'm done, I'm going to have every single African country with a different sound. So then you can hear the differences in us versus seeing it, which might help with stopping with that, the visual racism. Is now let's do auditory, let's use our ears to hear the differences instead of our eyes to see the differences. And it might help us interpret, things a bit more differently. So I got a lot to share with you.
Yes, well, it's a cliche. So when they say African, people have just a picture of everything being the same. So I think the differences in tones and differences and kinds of instruments used. When people say, I didn't know that they use violins or string instruments or flutes. So this work that you're doing is really something you...
There's other ways to use the research that I've done. So yeah, I'm excited to share with you.
Yes. So you have some things that are coming up, some dates that are coming up in places that people will be able to hear you or some of the projects that you're working with.
This weekend, this Saturday, I'm going to be facilitating a conversation for the MENA Film Festival about Blackness in the MENA region. And then the next Thursday, I'm going to be presenting for the BC Nurses Union Human Rights Conference. I'll be presenting my film.
Oh, I was going to ask, where could people hear or listen to any of
this? You need some more information about what I'm working on. ADHELproductions.com. So it's actually presenting our next film, which is going to be called The First Girls, which is going to be me traveling the world once COVID's over. I'm going to be traveling the world and going to interview former child soldiers former women child soldiers, and looking and exploring at the relationship between motherhood and intergenerational trauma, and looking back at their past and how it's shaped their future. So I'm really looking forward to, probably won't be till 2022 though, because of, we need a year after the vaccine, you know? So yeah, that's kind of it.
Yeah, and notice there are different things that you're working on with intergenerational trauma. What's another way that you could express that or help people to understand what that means?
So I can break it down in a scientific way. Maybe I'll be able to. So DNA, right? So our DNA is what makes us, right? And DNA is just memory. So each family member or whatever lineage or your family tree, right? You're getting a piece of them, each a person, and it's getting traveled into you. So that becomes your DNA. And so in your DNA, like genetic things get transferred, right? You get certain traits or certain things that are from your dad or from your mom or from your great grandma or blah, 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 blah. There's all these things that come in. So trauma can also be transferred into DNA as well, right? And it also affects the way that you interact and you engage between your immediate family. So let's say your mother's mother was neglectful, and then your mom ends up being neglectful, then you get it. So it becomes a cycle, right? So intergenerational trauma is pretty much passing down a traumatic incidences or PTSD or something that one person has experienced. It gets transferred into the to the child. And then that child ends up having these uncertain feelings or not understanding certain behaviors because it's something that is has been going on for a couple of generations, right? So I give you an example of Sudan, right? So where we come from has been over 25 years of civil war, right? This is just for the last 2.5 civil wars. And so within that, there's been so many awful things that have happened to the people of that region. And there's a lot of mothers who had to abandon their children. There's been deaths, there's been torture, there's all these things. And it's something that the people have just carried on, right? And people have turned into a survival mode. So in this survival mode, they weren't able to have the capacity or the ability to really heal or take care of the things they're going through because you just got to keep going. So when you get to a moment, let's say now we're in a new region, right? And the war is stopped. And now it's time to face what's happening on internally. And sometimes there's been so much that not only you've experienced, but also has been transferred to you through your genetics. So then there's all this mental health issues, right? There's depression, anxiety, all these different things because of this survival mode. And so when you look at it also from a psychological standpoint, the closest relationship you ever have is with your parent. So if your parent has trauma, you inherently take it. So it's just kind of like how you carry on certain pain and then it gets transferred to you. Even when you're in your mother's body, whatever that you're sitting in becomes what you've been born out into, right? So that's just the way the intergenerational trauma would work. So it's pretty much like how you get a certain trait from your great grandma. You got someone in your family has blue eyes, right? Okay, well, my great grandma has trauma. She was an orphan. So inherently, I have identity issues now, right? So that's just kind of like the way that I would try to explain what intergenerational trauma looks like. It's just trauma that just keeps getting passed on to each generation. And until someone confronts the underlying issue or looks back at the past and to understand what each person or which each person from the line has experienced, then it's hard to know why you harbor such things. So I don't know if I made a good explanation, but I hope it makes sense.
No, it's good. And I think, also myself as a filmmaker and you as a filmmaker, being able to translate these concepts into things people can see on the screen. And then the practice that's happening here, more and more people are discussing things. I think the shift from when you just went to a movie and maybe people had a little talk after it, now this facilitated discussions, similar to what you are taking part in this weekend. So I think that will help us to have a greater understanding and help where there are areas where there are conflicts in schools or whether there are places where there's war, this understanding and people that you're bringing together who are doing healing work around intergenerational trauma, it can help us to have a more humane, healthy, peaceful world.
Exactly. I think it's just really, I don't know, I feel like from the trauma and the things that I experienced as a child, I made a promise to myself that I don't want anyone to ever feel the things that I've ever felt, you know, it's just something that I felt really strong about, you know, not wanting people to experience pain, because I was so hurt for so long and so angry and just so not knowing what to do with my emotions. And then also coming from people who weren't giving the sympathy to try to, like, you know, you need that. And so I think that emptiness, you know, has gotten filled with the work that I do. And it's fueled me to want to have these discussions and to be like, look, like, even the fact that this girl has a film and she's from Qatar, right? And so we're even on different time zones having this conversation and being like, you see how universal this is? Some girl in Qatar, I'm a girl in Canada, you know, and someone from Edmonton, like, and one is, like, you know, Iranian, Afro-Iranian. He looks like a black guy, but his mom's from Iran, you know? So it's just so interesting. I think it's just really important to showcase how universal, you know, identity is and how complex it truly is. And it's not as simple as, oh, this is me. Like, this is my persona. Right. This is my, no, identity is so much deeper. It's so complex. Sometimes you got to just break it all down. Like, I could say, okay, this is my identity is I come from cow herding nomads from the Nilotic group in Sudan. All right. So that's my lineage. But how do I identify with that? I just look like it, right? And then, okay, what is my identity now that I have been moved out of that place? And now here I am in Canada, you know, in a white-dominated society. How do I fit into that? And, you know, and then, you know what I mean? It's just so many, like, layers. So it's about peeling it back and just having an understanding that identity is a complex, issue. And identity issues, especially from immigrants, you know, it is a complex issue. And just kind of like learning to love yourself and healing your internal traumas is what is the most important thing that we need to do. And so I think that, you know, the more we can educate people about identity and about trauma and their relationships to one another, I think we'll have more individualized people instead of people that are trying or that are being, you know, misled or, you know, like falling for the,
stereotype or, yes.
Exactly.
Simplification.
Exactly, like, start, like, we need to be individuals. And so understanding that the things that make us different and unique is okay. Like, we don't need to fit into a box. You know, I've never fit into a box. My family thought I was so weird because I watched anime and I was watching Korean dramas and learning Japanese. And I was super like, okay, I'm going to move to Asia when I'm finished high school. Like, this, like, and since elementary, since I was 12 years old, I'm like, I'm moving to Japan. And I was super like, that was my focus, you know? And I didn't do it, but now that's a big part of who I am, is that I've got, like, this side of me that has learned so much about a culture and about a language and learned to read and write and wanted to, like, be a part of that, you know? It really helped to open me up. Now it's helped me to be a more of a person. I can interact and engage with a variety of people now, instead of just trying to keep myself in a bubble to be like, okay, I'm only going to stick to my Africans or my Sudanese or my Black people. Like, no, I just want to see who I interact and I can engage with. I want to learn from them. So I think it's just trying to open up those layers, you know?
Yes, well, it's definitely been an enlightening conversation, and it gives a big example of even when your body, even when financial situations, when things change, if you employ some of these practices like you're doing, journaling, looking out to understand the world better, these are things that can help us to get further faster. And while it seems like we might be shut in, we really aren't isolated, and the time is there to learn another language, sing another song, discover something about the other people, not just in your neighborhood, but in your world. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me this morning. And I welcome the times that we'll be interjecting some of your research and music. And we're going to have some times that we connect what we do in the auditory realm in Speak Up, Listen Up, Act Upon with sometimes doing a YouTube Live or a Facebook Live so that the technology will allow you to join in. Just like talk radio will be video. You have a lot to digest from this morning. This is Sister C here in The Place to Be. And when they ask me, what time is it? I always say it's love time, poem time. Love time, poem time, love time.